morning.
Good morning, welcome to Senate Finance. It's Thursday, March 6th. It's about 7 minutes after nine. And thank you, Senator Olson, for the donuts. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
You brought your phone again today. Present at the table are Senator Meyer, Senator Olson, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop. Senator Fairclough has a bill up and will probably be in soon. Yeah. She'll be in to the meeting a little bit later. Today we're, yes, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on your thank you to Senator Olson. It probably would behoove us to tell the audience why he's bought the donuts for us. His cell phone went off. So you might want to take notice of that and turn your cell phones off now, unless, of course, you want to buy us donuts too, which is fine. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I was sitting right where Mike is sitting right now a few years ago when I was working for the university, and I had made great preparations to not have my phone in my pocket, and I checked them several times, and then I even went out to where my coat was hanging up thinking, yeah, it's a pretty loud ringer. I better make sure it's not in my coat, and it wasn't. I'm fine. I get up. I get called there. Senator Green is the chairman at the time. I start testifying, and my phone goes off, and I'm like, what is this, demonic or something? What happened is I had these pants with these pockets that kind of went around the back, and my cell phone had gone in and slid around the back. So every time I checked my pants, it felt like I didn't have a cell phone. Anyway, I was so cool. They did not know that I was the ringer. Anyway, so let's get on to some probably more pertinent business. We have some of the mayors representing municipalities with us today, and the discussion is going to be the effects of a gas line on their communities and the mechanisms for payments that they may receive. Mr. Navarre, Mayor Navarre and Mayor Hopkins, you have the floor. Please state your name and affiliation, and for the record, and go for it.
Yes, thank you very much. Mayor Luke Hopkins, Fairbanks, North Star Borough. Thank you very much for the invitation to appear before the committee as invited testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Kelly, Chairman Meyer, committee members. It's a pleasure to be here today, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about the impacts to local governments as you work towards what we hope will be a successful LNG and gas pipeline project. We are in agreement that it would be something that could be and should be in the best interest of the state and could provide long-term revenues for both the state and municipalities. There's a number of issues that we want to discuss that are relevant to local governments and concerns that we have regarding some of the things that we have reviewed up to this point, including the legislation and, more importantly, the heads of agreement. A group of us got together and started talking about this issue, the Kenai Peninsula Borough, the North Slope Borough, Fairbanks North Star Borough, and Valdez, and have invited other communities that may be along the route, Denali Borough, Matsu Borough, and discussion invited Anchorage even to participate in some of the discussions about what the impacts might be to municipalities and what we should raise as issues we have of concern. Of course, the biggest concern is the language in the heads of agreement that references legislation that will be brought forward next year, presumably, or if things move forward, that will allow for construction of a pipeline and the facilities necessary to monetize our natural gas resources. And the concern there is that there's reference made to a payment in lieu of taxes, and other items that might be needed in order to have a successful project. And while we recognize that there may be some concessions for a project of this size, and could probably even support them, we don't know what those will be. We don't know what it's going to look like. We don't know what the impacts are. We know and we can calculate based on what the status quo is and existing delegated authority of the municipalities, but we don't know what this is going to look like. And the language in the heads of agreement says the state will consult with us. And you all know the meaning of different terms, and consult is not really a very strong word. We would rather have agreement in that process and what that structure looks like, or if not agreement in it, then we would like to negotiate our deal on our own behalf. With respect to other languages and things that might be in that, past negotiations between the state and the major companies have resulted in a discussion of other fiscal certainty terms, such as existing oil properties. And one of the concerns is that because tax bases in the, for the existing oil infrastructure is a big part of local government tax revenues, that should not be changed and should not be included in the concessions that are being talked about with respect to a natural gas facility and natural gas pipeline, because it would really upset a lot of areas. And while we recognize that the companies are going to be taking significant risk, the state of Alaska is taking significant risk too, and I would expect that the companies who come to the table would do the very best job that they could and want to bring anything and everything they can into these types of negotiations to their benefit. That's what they should do, and that's what they will do. And I know that you, as members of the Alaska Senate and the legislature, will look out for Alaska's interests. And we're here because we want to make sure that in the course of that, we raise the issues that we see as important to local governments and how it will impact us. And of course, the contractual provisions change significantly what the legislative role will be over time. It's a way to lock in fiscal certainty, which nobody really knows exactly what that means. And so we would like to make sure that as we're looking at contractual arrangement that will really reduce the opportunities to look back or to change taxing structures over time, that we make sure that we have identified as much as we can and ask you to address our concerns. And we're happy to answer any question. We did receive a letter from the committee chairs that raised a number of issues that we would be happy to discuss at your pleasure.
Thank you, Mayor Navarre. Mayor Hopkins?
Yes, thank you. Our group of mayors have been trying to track SB 138 and the conditions that it allows the administration to go forward and negotiate. The issue of a PILT agreement, and you know, as you heard from the other mayor here, it talks about the discussions of it, and we're concerned that as I've had experience with PILT agreements, it's both sides agree to a value, and then that's what goes forward to the legislative bodies for their approval. So, what I'm concerned with and the other mayors is that maybe we sit down and negotiate, but yet we can't come to a conclusion, and that would be unfortunate. We would certainly ask that that amendments to this legislation state specifically that there would be a consent by the municipalities as the Commissioner of Natural Resources and others sit down and negotiate with the producers. On the other piece, Mayor Navarre spoke to the issue of fiscal certainty, and in the heads of agreement there's statements in there and Section 10 that speak to the healthy long-term oil business and reducing valuation and other potential disputes between the producer parties and the state. And so that for us, I would ask that you strongly consider inserting language into this legislation that says it does not affect both those items in Title 29 and 4356 on existing oil and gas properties, and that's an important word. There's methodologies, sideboards on how impact aid is computed. Those are pieces that we can certainly continue speaking to. Sure. So far, the Our in-depth review of the bill brings forward this existing oil and gas infrastructure concerns and then how a PILT agreement is arrived at this point. So thank you very much for this opportunity to bring this forward.
Mayor Hopkins, Mayor Navarre, what at this point, what is your level of discussion with the administration been on this?
Well,
I think both of us have spoken to some folks in the administration. I spoke yesterday with Mike Pulowski, and he had, I think, a better understanding of what our concerns were and referenced the fact that, well, we can't do any of this anyway. We can't negotiate away existing oil properties in a contract because, and they can't. They can't. But what concerns us and what I articulated to him was that, but what the heads of agreement says is that once the parties agree, they bring forth legislation and support that legislation before the legislature, and that means they can bring forward anything. And may, while they may not have statutory authority now, they'll ask for it. They'll say, here's the five things we need in order to get this thing done. And the concern is that if we don't raise the issue now and let you at least know what our concerns are, when we come back next year, you'll say you should have been here last year asking us what was going on. Or when it comes forward next year, the dynamic of it, of the discussion and debate, changes to this is what has to be. You can't change any of these terms going forward because these are the things that we agreed with that we need. And so that concerns us.
And as you know, we also submitted a letter to the governor asking to meet with him, and also submitted a similar letter to ask to meet with Commissioner Bailash and Commissioner Rodell. So I met with Commissioner Bailash and Commissioner Rodell day before yesterday, I believe, and had very good conversations with them. Mike Pulowski was there also, and those same concerns that Mayor Navarre raised that Mr. Pulowski brought forward, we spoke to those in depth. But Commissioner Bailash understood our points and understood that this is something to certainly discuss in this legislation as sideboards.
Thank you. Just a point, I'm not sure you're aware, just the governor had a death in the family and he's going to be out of pocket for a little while.
Yeah.
Just when we're trying to put all this together by the time the CS comes out. walk me through the mechanics just so I'm sure of this. So we have the MOU and the heads of agreement, and that's signed. I mean, that exists regardless of the legislation, and then the legislature triggers us going to the next step. So we put in this piece of legislation some mechanism that brings in the municipalities to discuss and be part of an agreement to address their needs. And that wouldn't change anything in the MOU. It establishes your path forward. I guess I'm just kind of talking out loud here to make sure that we aren't trying to, that the challenge that I've seen on this bill is so many people, not referencing you at all, but so many people talk about things that aren't in the bill. And we're talking about these huge gas line issues sometimes, and we're trying to get to pre-feed. And so I'm just trying to make sure as we go forward to pull in some of your concerns that we even have a mechanism available to do that. And that's not a... That's not a counter to anything you've said. I think the committee needs to think of that. Senator Bishop and then Senator Meyer. No, Senator Bishop? No? Okay. We have, as well as Mayor Hopkins and Mayor Navarre, if you guys want to stay at the table, I appreciate it. We also have on the phone Clay Walker from Denali Borough. And Clay, Mayor Walker, did you want to, there's nobody on there, okay. We have no one? Oh, okay. Well, apparently Charlotte's going to call in. Mayor Brower from the North Slope is going to call in at 9:30. Mayor Navarre?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I do want to, I did meet with the governor a couple of weeks ago when I was down, and he said, well, yeah, we're going to talk with communities. It's too early for a lot of this discussion. It's too early for a lot of this discussion. And specifically when you're talking about contractual arrangements, you know, we know as municipalities we're unlikely to be in that room when they're negotiating this, and it will all be done in confidentially, and we won't get to see anything until they come forward with legislation that says, here it is. Right. And so while it may be premature for us to have specific discussions, it's not premature to raise the issues that we have a concern with and let at least the administration, which we have tried to do, and the legislature know what we're concerned with. And I think that in terms of what you put into legislation that you draw as sideboards for the administration when they go into negotiations is important. And I think that they'll pay attention to it. If you say, okay, we want you to go forward, but be aware that we don't want you to come back with, or we would prefer you not come back with, these types of things written into the agreement. And if you put that in as sort of instructions to the people who are going in to negotiations with what they're going to come back to, I think it will change the dynamic of what comes back. And I think that all Alaskans have a vested interest in this. All communities are going to be impacted one way or another because, as you all well know, particularly on the Finance Committee, municipalities are part of the state. We get a heck of a lot of support from the state for all kinds of things. And we appreciate that and hope you'll treat us well this year.
Mayor Navarro, your opinion carries a lot of weight with this group. You spent a lot of time in these halls. You were co-chair of finance over in the House. Is intent language something that would work or not? What do you think?
You know, we have proposed some amendments for the legislation that would basically say that the contracts may not change these specific items. Now, it says may not change it, and I know that doesn't change the fact that the administration can go forward with negotiations and bring back to you anything that the heads of agreement says they can bring back to you. But at least you will have said, we're going to put extra scrutiny on issues like this that come back before us.
Okay. Senator Olson, Mayor Hopkins?
Yeah, thank you. You know, when I read through the, you know, 50 pages or so of the bill, there are many specifics in there about what will move forward. You know, this is a piece just to add more specificity to those two areas as we proposed some amendment language, and as opposed to intent. It concerns us that, you know, maybe in intent we forgot some other piece in there.
Apparently we do have now Mayor Walker online. Mayor Walker, do you want to testify?
Mayor Walker, do you want to testify?
We're having before you.
Yeah,
have any,
thank you.
There you go.
Thank you, Senate Finance Committee, for the invitation to testify.
Thank you, Senate Finance Committee, for the invitation to testify.
Mm-hmm. Sorry about the technological delay there. I can sort of hear you, and I want to thank the mayors for forwarding this issue in terms of the mayors and the representative municipalities being at the table. And also for the Denali Borough, I'd like to say that we do support the methodology included in the HOA of a PILT payment with impact funds, and look forward to being a part of the discussion and I believe negotiation. And I think that's an important point that Mayor Hopkins brought up relative to consultation or negotiation. And like to, thanks for being part of it.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. Just for the record, Senator Fairclough is back from her committee where she was testifying. And anyone, questions, Senator Olson?
Actually, I do, Mr. Chairman. Mayor Walker, there apparently have been amendments or an amendment drafted to try and protect some of the municipalities like the borough. Have you seen these, and are you in agreement if you have seen them?
I have not seen the proposed amendment, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And as far as I know, you guys are kind of working as a team, correct? All right. So, and I have, he's not a member of this committee, but I've asked, as we're trying to move the bill from this committee, I've asked Peter Michicki to work with you regarding some of this language and how to proceed forward, and he's obviously available to you to do that. We're trying to get a bill out, CS out next Monday, and so any language you could get between now and then would be appreciated. And Mike, if you could work with these guys, it would surely be appreciated. As I look at this bill, I see about four things, and so I'm doing this one from memory. Bill's one of them that we've got to figure out. We've got to figure out what our take is. We've got to figure out what our participation is. And I always forget the fourth one. But anyway, we definitely have to get this taken care of before it moves from this committee. I would hope we could. Your concerns, I think, are certainly need consideration. I appreciate you coming. Oh, Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. As you said, I had a bill up in Senate State Affairs, so I don't know if this has already been addressed, but I would just say that we absolutely want to protect our municipalities, but we also want to keep enough leverage for a project to actually happen. So I know that that's the intent of everyone at this table, but any language for consideration, at least for me, we'll need to make sure that we have flexibility in the state's position in negotiating with our parties. This is a commercial agreement, much different than the state being able to tell people what to do inside of a contractual obligation. We certainly can negotiate if we want to be in that arrangement. We can also not get a project depending on what we place inside of the legislation. So I'll be cautiously optimistic that we can arrive on a process that we can meet that expectation to.
Mayor Navarre.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Fairclough. The I think we're all in agreement that we want a project. The heads of agreement references specifically alignment of interest between the state and the other parties to that agreement. And there should really be an alignment between the state and local governments on this, only because it's a significant change from where we're at now. We don't want to stop the project, but we also, in terms of what gets negotiated into it, everybody should be concerned if we're talking about somehow rolling existing oil taxable properties into this mix, because there's already such a significant reliance on that at the local government level. And if we're, and you know, the fact of the matter is a lot of those things can be changed over time. Last year the Senate passed Senate Bill 21. I mean the legislature passed Senate Bill 21. And that was a significant change. Now did that provide some fiscal certainty? Probably. Things can change over time. It's just that drafting them into a contractual arrangement of some kind or compromising them at the front end of a project is something that I think is significant. If we're limiting it to monetizing the gas, that is something I think nobody is in disagreement to. It's a matter of figuring out who gets what share. Total government take is a key component of that, and we recognize that, and we recognize that the state is impacted as much as anyone by a project like this.
We'll take a brief at ease. Go ahead, Senator Dunleavy. Mayor Brower is going to be calling in a few minutes.
Sure, just briefly. Mayor Navarre, I'm not sure if I heard this correctly, but in this process of trying to figure out something up front, I guess one would imagine that the municipalities would more or less have to come in as a group. How would you address, for example, if we go down the road, and do you foresee a municipality still having veto power down the road? In other words, is this something we need to get done quickly, not quickly, but done up front before we move down the road? And if not, how do you envision language or a mechanism by which municipalities act as one, so there's some alignment and certainty, as opposed to municipalities having veto power going down the road?
Well, and I don't think that municipalities should have veto power. You know, I don't. And I don't think that we're going to get that either. But I do think that there needs to, you know, a tilt is different than what's being done now. So determining what that looks like and how that's allocated is a key part of this, because I have been in the legislature in the past, and there's always competition for any money that's available. So if you have a PILT that is paid, in order to make it simple, paid to the state, and then the state decides how it's allocated, that can change over time. And so from my standpoint, there needs to be, as the mayor of the Kenai Borough, and all of the mayors who have participated in this and the municipalities have a little bit of interest and a little bit different take on it. What I want to see if we're going with a PILT is that there's, at least from the standpoint where it's designated or currently the lead site is Nikiski for the terminus and the LNG facilities. If that's the case, then my communities will be significantly impacted. So I want some relationship between where the assets are sited and where the long-term impacts are, and whatever a PILT looks like. With respect to impact aid, when the pipeline is being constructed, that's going to look significantly different. Kenai Peninsula will be impacted, but so will Fairbanks and Anchorage and everybody who's along the corridor, and the North Slope Borough along the corridor where it will be built, and ports that bring materials in. So there will be a lot of impacts during construction.
And it's, I think, Senator Dunleavy, it's important. I certainly wouldn't support anything that would result in a veto power. And Mayor Navarre just said he wouldn't support that either. Doesn't think that should be the deal. But I think what we're looking at is we have to put something in place for the next step so that it's already there that guides negotiations kind of through that little gate. Is that accurate,
yeah.
Mayors? Yeah. Mayor Hawkins.
On that note, my discussions with Commissioner Balash was that, you know, would something like a MAG group that was in the Stranded Gas Act that our community participated in to collect information and try to work at some level, well, that that's possible, but then when, you know, the Kenai Peninsula Borough has a particular value that they might start at with the state in the negotiation of a PILT, Fairbanks North Star Borough might have a different one, Denali Borough would, and you know the those pieces have to be should be rolled in somehow to, you know, to have a fair process. I think
I don't think I am going to make any kind of statements or commitments about how this should look. I agree with the fact that there needs to be consideration for the municipalities before we take the next step. And I don't want my statements about the CS coming out to be misunderstood either. I want to have either discussed and decided on what we're going to do with the municipalities before the CS comes out. I wasn't trying to make the statement that we'll fix your problem in the CS. So just so everyone is clear on that. I'm going to take just a little minute here. Did you have another question, Senator Fairclough? Take a little at ease here, and we're going to wait for Mayor Brower to come online.
Mayor Brower, you're online, and I probably gaveled a little too soon because some of the members had left the table while we were waiting for you to call in. And I'm actually going to call another at ease as people come back, because I don't want you testifying to too many empty chairs. So we'll be right back with you.
Okay. Thank you.
Back on the record, we have Mayor Brower online. Welcome to Senate Finance. You have senators are present, and you have Mayor Hopkins and Mayor Navarro at the table with us. And I believe Mayor Walker is also online. So go ahead, Charlotte, with your testimony.
Good morning, Co-Chairman Kelly, Co-Chairman Meyer, and senators. My name is Charlotte Brower, and I'm honored to be the mayor of the North Slope Borough. I'm wife of a whaling captain and blessed with 6 children and 25 grandchildren.
Amen.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak on Senate Bill 138, a bill that authorizes the state of Alaska to move forward on developing a natural gas line from the North Slope to Tidewater. Today I would like to talk about some of the concerns and interests of the North Slope Borough regarding Senate Bill 138 and the Heads of Agreement, which is a separate document that outlines the guiding principles of the Alaska LNG project. I'm also here to offer some suggestions on how those concerns could be addressed by this committee, the legislature, the governor, and his administration. Before we talk about concerns, it's important that say thank you to our good Lord for the opportunity to be having discussion on how to build a $40 to $50 billion project to develop our natural gas. How many other legislatures or mayors would love to trade places with us right now? The Alaska LNG project envisions a 20 to 25% ownership by the state of Alaska. This requires the legislature to evaluate complicated policy decisions and risk and costs on a level equal with decisions made by Fortune 500 companies. Please let me take a moment to acknowledge our appreciation for your efforts on behalf of our residents. You are truly deciding the future of our state, and on behalf of the North Slope Borough, I commend you. As Alaskans, we've learned from the past that large projects like this can set a positive course for our future, but we also know that in order to provide the maximum possible benefits, we have to be prepared for the impacts. For example, the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline has provided billions of dollars of revenue and jobs. But we also learn lessons about demands for public services to deal with social services, job training, infrastructure, public safety, and education. This brings me to the points that should be addressed in Senate Bill 138 and the Heads of Agreement document before this committee. The Heads of Agreement has language in Article 9.3 that states, quote, parties, end of quote, intend for the project fiscal terms to be included in project enabling contracts, subject to, quote, consultation, end of quote, with local governments. The administration will establish payment in lieu of property tax, which is called PILT, which are to be based on a unit rate per throughput basis. In other words, the payment is calculated as cents per 1,000 cubic feet of natural gas. The reason for concern is that the process for consultation is not defined. We see that this process for enabling contracts is an up or down ratification vote by the legislature after the administration submits them to you for approval. If the local taxing authority of municipal governments is going to be modified to provide fiscal certainty, we must be part of the process. Let me now turn to the language in Senate Bill 138. The current language in Senate Bill 138 addresses the taxing authority of local municipal government in three different sections. First, the Senate Resource Committee added legislative intent language in Section 1 that the interests of local government entities must be considered in contract negotiations to protect the financial and other interests of the local governmental entities. The addition of this language is recognized and appreciated, but it does not have the force of law and does not go far enough. Second, in Section 8 of the bill, the state-created subsidiary is given the legal provisions created in current law for Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, known as AGDC. This includes the language in Alaska Statutes 31.25.260, which exempts AGDC from municipal taxes for any property owned by AGDC. In addition, this section of law further exempts taxable property for any joint venture or partnership with AGDC during construction of the pipeline. This creates confusion because the new subsidiary for the large diameter project is given all the benefits provided to AGDC, but there are two completely separate and distinct projects. In the case of the Alaska LNG project in SB 138, there is a very large project that proposes to have significant state ownership. This was not the model that was envisioned when the legislature discussed the formation of AGDC last year during the hearings on House Bill 4. Third, the commissioners of Department of Natural Resources and Revenue are provided authority to negotiate enabling contracts that must be ratified by the legislature. Based on the language in HOA, these enabling contracts will be used to establish a PILT system and also establish a series of impact payments during project construction. I am here today to request your consideration for making any amendments to SB 138 and other changes that will protect the interests of local governments. Before discussing those amendments, I would like to provide some background. Less than 3 weeks ago, I was fortunate enough to offer testimony to House Resources Committee in Juneau in Senate Bill of House Joint Resolution 26. HJR 26 is a resolution calling upon the United States Congress to pass legislation that establish a revenue sharing program from the proceeds of oil and gas development on the outer continental shelf off our shores. Earlier this week, HJR 26 passed the Senate on a vote of 17-0, and I want to thank you for your vote. By working together as Alaskans, we are sending a message for receiving a fair and equitable distribution of revenues that come from energy development off our shores. It was our combined message as state and local governments that we will need resources to keep up with infrastructure requirements, expand emergency response and search and rescue capabilities, and work to maintain healthy communities and a healthy ecosystem. When it comes to dealing with the impacts of oil and gas development, the basic discussion between offshore and onshore is not really that much different, as the local government responsible for providing basic essential services, the North Slope Borough is there to help provide for costs of schools, emergency response, health and social services, and public safety. Like most other municipal governments, the North Slope Borough relies upon our authority to levy a property tax in order to generate the revenue to provide these public services. That is why any discussion to exempt property taxes from a project of this magnitude gives me cause for concern. This is not the first time we've discussed the development of a natural gas pipeline, the issue of fiscal stability for the project, and I continue to believe that municipal taxes are not the issues that makes or breaks the margin on a project that could exceed $50 billion. On behalf of the North Slope Borough, I would like to request your consideration for the following amendment to Senate Bill 138. One, the newly created subsidiary should not be provided the tax exemption provided to AGDC for the small in-state project. In particular, the tax exemption under Alaska Statute 31.25.260 should not apply to the large diameter project in Senate Bill 138. Two, let's explore ways for municipalities to participate in the project. For all the reasons that the project benefits from participation by the state of Alaska, perhaps many of the concerns of municipalities could be addressed in the same manner. For example, perhaps municipal governments could access revenues and get access to natural gas by having an ownership stake in a portion of the project. Three, the governor has the authority to issue administrative orders that could establish an advisory working group of municipal officials, administrative officials, industry participants, and others. Perhaps this approach could be explored to get conversations started to resolve some of those concerns. No one wants to see a natural gas pipeline more than myself. I see the opportunity for my grandchildren and many of the children to have good jobs, and I also want to see access to affordable energy for all our children in the North Slope and in the state of Alaska. In order to get jobs and access to affordable energy, our villages will need good schools, housing, and other basic services in order to take advantage of the opportunities. And for that reason, I'm here today to speak up for the ability of our municipal government to have the authority to meet those needs.
Thank you, Mayor Brower. We really appreciate your testimony. Are there questions of the committee or by the committees? Hearing none, Mayor Hopkins and Navarre, did you have further comments?
If I may, in closing, just to let this body know, as we looked at the legislation, you know, questions in the other questions in the heads of agreement and the and the memorandum, you know, how is impact aid decided? And I raised that issue before. How is it determined the amounts that are distributed to municipalities? Where the five takeoff points are? How is that decided? Do municipalities have any role in that? I know that my borough is very concerned with, you know, that there's a takeoff point close by. We would think that there would be, but how are some of those points done? But, you know, going back to our, you know, our most important pieces, you know, are the issues of of the existing taxation and then being able to sit down and negotiate and consent with the PILT agreements. Not saying that PILT agreements should not be here. I'm sure that's a, you know, the mayors will have many discussions about that. But for this project to move forward, it's probably, you know, pretty darn clear. It's certainly clear to me that PILT agreements are going to be part of it. Okay. So with that, you know, again, thank you for this opportunity to answer questions and to discuss our points.
Senator Olson.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Mayor, since you're involved with the whole, I would like you to comment on the three suggested amendments to 138 that Mayor Brower went ahead and proposed or recommended. Are you in favor of them, and are there other things that are not on the list that you feel strongly about, I guess is the real question?
So I haven't had an opportunity to sit down with Mayor Brower and discuss all of those points. I know that we've had discussions about those representatives from the four municipalities that we spoke to at the beginning, or spoke of at the beginning, and you know, it's a moving target, and we're trying to nail it down. I know that the concern with the Section 31, I'm not totally familiar with all the parts of Section 31, but you know, going back to the taxation piece is fairly clear on that. The other pieces of takeoff and impact, the mayor from North Slope Borough spoke to those impact pieces, and there's no sideboards yet for that discussion. So certainly look forward to speaking with her as soon as possible and seeing if we can submit our other concerns as a group for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mayor Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a realist, and I recognize that municipalities are not going to be part of the negotiations between the parties that are of the heads of agreement. And all of you know, just from being in the legislature, that oftentimes someone else has to negotiate on your behalf. And in general, although not always, in general, the people who are doing the negotiation know more about how you got to where you got to, and they also look out first for their interests and then for the interests of the people who aren't in the room. That is in general, although not specifically. And so that's what our concern is and why we're raising the impact to local governments. Having said that, you know, I was part of the legislature for 12 years. I trust the process if it's allowed to work. One of the things that I am concerned with is we now have 90-day sessions, and I know you can extend those sessions, but 90-day sessions for very complex issues is sometimes inadequate. I know that you spend a lot of time researching these issues, discussing these issues, and I think that when legislation comes before you next year, you will do your due diligence and you'll look out for the state's interest and also for municipal interest. And it's our responsibility now as mayors to pay attention to what's going on also and let you know what our concerns are going forward, because the dynamic of the debate changes when legislation is before you that could result in a $65 billion investment in the state of Alaska. And at that point, some of the debate and discussion will turn on, we want this to happen, we want it to go forward. And in the case of that, most people will be in favor of that, but the details of what it means long term will be known only by really a few, mostly you here in this room and in the legislature, because that's your job and your responsibility. I have delved into some of the materials that have been presented on the heads of agreement and the legislation, but I can't do it full time. And so you're going to know more about it. You're going to participate in the negotiations. You're going to be part of the discussions with the administration. And when the legislation comes back before you, while it may not be allowed now in law, a simple line that said, notwithstanding the provisions of whatever, this is what we agreed to. And so we're not trying to stop the negotiations. What we're trying to do is put some sidebars on it that protect what we think are municipal concerns. And also, we're concerned about the impacts to the state long term, because municipalities don't just share in revenues as a result of facilities that are in their communities. We also share in revenues that go to the state as a result of the state's resource base. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the time and opportunity.
Thank you, Mayors. Really appreciate you coming down here. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First off, I'd like to thank all the mayors today for here in person and those testifying online. I think you've all done an admirable job, and none of your requests or concerns or things that you've brought to us are over the top. I think they're just pure common sense, good question approaches to this process, because I just want to take a step back from that. We've heard time and time again how big a project this is. I mean, Mayor Brower, I mean, she said something to me that just rocked me back. She says, how many other legislators would like to be sitting at a table negotiating a $50 to $65 billion deal? That's huge. Think about that. And, you know, we do things big in Alaska, and we kind of toss billion-dollar numbers around like it's folding money, but that really set the tone for me. But we've heard expert testimony from two different consultants, others in the room. This project has got to be on time, on budget, to meet the window, because it is such a huge project, and we have to be competitive to have a deal. And part of that having a deal is making sure that our munis are on board with the deal. So I concur with your comments. I hope that we can get there so that we're all in sync to meet the on-time, on-schedule process of this project. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Any other questions or comments? Hearing none, thank you, Mayors. Thank you, Mayor Brower and Walker online. This concludes the meeting today. We do not have a 5 o'clock tonight. Did we do? We'll be back here at 5 o'clock, so we're not going to adjourn. We're going to recess until 5 o'clock. Please have the amendments on this to us by Friday. And our office will get with you to make sure that we're all drafting to the same amendment or the same version. Senator Meyer?
Yeah, thank you. You could adjourn this meeting, and then we'll start another meeting at 5 o'clock, but I anticipate tonight's meeting to be relatively short as well. We do, Senator Coghill has that omnibus crime bill that we want to get started on, so
yeah.
Thank you.
Without any other questions or comments or something for the good of the order, we are adjourned.
Okay, we're going to call the Thursday evening meeting to order. With us thus far, Senator Kelly, I expect Senator Olson, and Senator Dunleavy, Senator Fairclough. So we have a quorum. See, it's my understanding that we will not be taking up Senate Bill 138, which was the gas bill. So if anybody's here for gas, not tonight. But we will be taking up Senate Bill 64. This is a bill we started a while ago, actually, and I think Senator Coghill's here. What we had was a PowerPoint presentation. What we'd like to do tonight, it's a pretty large bill, so we'd like to go through it in a little more detail, section analysis, so we can understand the bill. And then take any questions from committee. Monday morning, I don't, we're not doing gas Monday either. Is that right, Senator Kelly?
Monday we'll probably, yes, we'll have this, yes, or excuse me, the amendments to us by tomorrow. We hope to talk together at CES.
By Monday night.
We hope to have the amendments or suggestions for a CS into us by tomorrow, and it's possible we'll have it up Monday,
okay.
but for sure Tuesday.
All right, so Monday morning we may take up the Senate Bill 138. If not, we'll just continue our discussion here with Senate Bill 64. Okay, so with that, then Tuesday we plan on taking public testimony on this bill, Senate Bill 64, the Omnibus Crime Bill. So with that, we have the sponsor here, Senator Coghill, and his trusty staff, Jordan Schilling. Senator Coghill, could you please join us and tell us about the bill? Senator Coghill, floor is yours.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Coghill from Fairbanks North Pole area, thank you for taking up again the Senate Bill 64. Greatly appreciate it. I'm going to, if it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, what I'd like to do is have Jordan Schilling, who has lived and breathed this bill for the last several months, kind of go through the sectional with you. There are a couple of points, though, that I would like to kind of emphasize. Because of the last meeting, my staff got in a little bit of trouble because I had put a couple of things in the bill that that probably known to me primarily were areas where I felt fairly strongly on. For years, we've been trying to get a felony theft threshold, excuse the tongue twister, level higher. And at this point, 750 is high as I can actually commit to. And I know I started off much higher, but it's really because of the business community. I just have not been able to get to them to agree. And I think that just practically, I don't know that I can have enough public support and support in this whole building for me to move beyond that. So I just wanted to say that out loud. I do personally believe that there's a better way to do it. Then the other thing is the commission in here does have a cost to it, but I don't want to apologize for the cost. I think that's going to be very important. What we've done, you've heard both the Supreme Court Justice Carbonetti speak to it. You've heard other people, and I would only reiterate that we have created sentencing structures that really need to be reviewed. That is the mandated sentencing structures. They need to be reviewed and commented on, and maybe suggestions to change. Some of the court flexibility, some of the standards need to be looked at. Some of our DUI laws over the years have come to us in kind of various different arrangements that we need to think through and look at probably in a little more holistic fashion. So I think the commission can help us think through some of those things. Certainly, I think the legislature carries prime responsibility for it, but I think the commission is going to be one of the main things. The other thing is alcohol really is kicking the feet out from under us in Alaska. I think there are some things in here, the 24/7 program being the key element. But in that key element, you're going to see us trying to put together a funding structure for those that come out of jail. I expect that we're going to have savings from jails. I mean, one of the primary purposes is to keep from building another jail within the next 10 or 15 years, which it should already be on the drawing board if we're going to do that. If we do not create an avenue for post-jail accountability and programmatic approaches, no doubt our recidivism is going to be higher. So with a 24/7 accountability and some programmatic approach to those getting out of jail, those are elements I think that from what I've seen nationally and in the state, our recidivism is going to go down with those kind of accountable measures. So I just wanted to reiterate some of those things that you got to hear at the highest level, but I did abandon my staff to go through it. And with that, Mr. Chairman, unless there's questions for me specifically, probably a sectional review would be the wisest thing. It is a fairly long bill, but we can go through those sections rather rapidly. And so unless you have questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Caldwell. By the way, I want to welcome Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You actually brought it up. I know it's in the bill buried somewhere, but the felony threshold, it does seem like 750 is kind of a small amount for felony, and I know it costs us a fortune to put and bring forward a felony case to the courts. But you said there wasn't much wiggle room there?
Mr. Chairman, there are groups in Alaska, mostly in the National Federation of Independent Businesses, who feel very strongly that if it goes up to $1,000, this portion of the bill will not make it. And to be fair, I've been trying for almost 8 years now to get that level up, and have hit that ceiling every single time and have not been able to get the bill advanced. So as you can see, it's a practical matter on my part. I actually believe that it should be higher, but I can tell you the commitment I made was to keep it at this level so that we could move forward.
Okay, and we'll get into the costs and the fiscal notes as we go along, but do you have a ballpark idea what it costs to bring forward a felony case versus a misdemeanor case?
Off the top of my head, I do not. Okay. I can get that to you before you make action on this bill, though.
Well, and I see Annie Carpinetti and some others in the audience that probably could help us with
that. The way I've described it, Mr. Chairman, it's a little bit like using a D8 cat to do the maintenance on your front lawn. Yeah. I mean, it's really that different.
Okay. Senator Fairclough?
Mr. Chairman, there's a reason why Fred Meyer, we have a letter from Fred Meyer, so I just want to put that on the record. And some of these smaller, that would be big business, but there's small businesses that don't want the change. But if we looked at the underlying problem, I think what it is they're afraid that police officers won't respond because they have to investigate at different levels. So maybe we could hear what the real issue is, because if the real issue is investigation and holding people accountable versus what we bear in costs as a state, and that is the corrections, the courts, and building that entire case, maybe there's something that we can address to take a look at that number.
Mr. Chairman, there's two things I'm trying to do. One of them is I'm trying to get an audience with some of the council that has the NFIB. And I just have not been able to get that, partly because of my schedule, partly because of theirs. The other thing is, I did have one police officer actually testify in committee that has created some of that pushback, and they said they didn't respond to misdemeanors. And then I've got a group of police officers who said that is just not the case. It's just that higher level crimes will take them quite often, take them off property crimes issues. But misdemeanors and property crimes are on their list of things to do. And it was just, to me, unfortunate that at the time I got that one, and that seems to be one of the main things that people are keying in on. So I could get all kinds of testimony, but I still have that one there on the record. And so it's just something we got to deal with.
Okay. Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, my point is that there's a reason that that the other side of the coin, per se, those that have been victimized by somebody stealing from them, they have an issue. And if we understood what that issue was, maybe we could work to be able to advance the number, because we are being, it's causing the state to actually have to pay a significant portion of money to be able to process that, these through. And so I would hope that their goal isn't to just throw people or kids in jail. They have a higher calling for accountability would be my guess, and maybe we could ask them questions to find out. I'm sure it's much more complicated, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, it is somewhat complicated. Some of these misdemeanors can be a year in jail and a $10,000 fine, you know, so it's no small matter, but there's civil action that they can get. Having a felony, though, gives them a much bigger leverage. There's no doubt about that. But I think what, and if I was speaking to NFIB right now, I would say these are the very people that you're going to have resumes in front of you that if they have a felony on them, you're not going to be able to hire them. And they may have very well reformed over the 10 years that they have done that. So it's one of those things that I think is highly unfortunate that you would use such a big hammer that has such a long, lifelong effect. Rural communities probably get much more dramatic effects because once you do something in an area outside of the road system, the costs are just higher, and naturally you're going to have that problem. But I made the case, but I do need to talk to the NFIB. And it's really kind of a reality matter. This part of the bill just would not make it, I think, at this point.
Okay. Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to point out that I've never had an electronic device disrupt this committee before.
I think Senator Dunleavy knows that he's going to buy us donuts tomorrow.
My phone.
Yeah, it was your phone.
That's like saying it was not my dog. It was in your pocket. So, Mike, but I do have an actual pertinent.
You have a question?
I'd like to know what the difference between, I'd like an analysis, and if it's in here, I didn't see it, between what we're paying for felonies versus non-felony. If we raise that threshold, is there a way to just have it kind of gradated? If we raise it this much, it's going to cost, or it's going to save the state this much. If it's raised more, it's going to save it this much more. I think that's a valuable discussion right now, because as much as I want to help constituents who are struggling with this, the decision honestly is made at this table and we're held accountable to them, but we need the information, and I'd like to have that information.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll try to do my best to get a simple matrix on that. You do have to call a jury, you call after grand jury, you have to do the charging, you have to do the plea bargaining. There are definitely cost factors, and I'll try to get them quantified in a good, easy matrix that I can show the difference between if you had a felony of $800 under a felony or an $800 under a misdemeanor, what the cost difference would be. So I'll kind of set it at the $800 and we'll go from there.
Okay. I think actually tonight I don't want to go too late because I know we've been kind of going late every night this week, and so we'll let you walk us through the bill, and then we'll take questions at the end. You have several people online too. Rick Allen with the Office of Public Advocacy, Ron Taylor, Department of Corrections, Quinlan Steiner, Public Defender, and Suzanne DiPietro with the Alaska Judicial Council.
DiPietro.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, I think most of them are here for questions.
Okay.
And I've instructed Jordan Schilling, who's going to walk you through the sectional, to do it rapidly.
Okay. Well, and then, like I said, we'll take questions at the end, and probably more likely have this bill before us again in the morning. In the morning, we can take additional questions and or then get into the fiscal notes, which is, of course, of great interest to us.
And, Mr. Chairman, at this point, if I'll just sit back and I'll start writing up whatever questions I think, and I'll leave him at the desk for you unless you require my presence here.
No, that's fine. You can let Jordan go solo here. Senator Coghill. Okay, thank you, Senator Coghill. Jordan, if you can put your name on the record, please.
Thank you, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. And what we have before us is version D. And what I'd like to do is just quickly describe the eight main components of the bill, and then I'll go through in detail section by section. So the eight main pieces of Senate Bill 64, it establishes a 24/7 sobriety program that's used to prevent offenders from drinking. Senate Bill 64 creates the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. It expands a program called PACE, which is a different way of doing probation. It requires that the Department of Corrections conduct more assessments on their prisoners. Senate Bill 64 also establishes a recidivism reduction fund, and that's to grant money to transitional reentry programs. The bill, of course, increases the felony theft threshold from $500 to $750. It establishes stricter penalties for attempted abduction. That's the first few sections of the bill. And then lastly, the bill incentivizes treatment. So as I said, the first three sections of the bill, they fill a gap in our criminal codes relating to attempted child abduction. And last committee I described a scenario where that might happen, but really what it is it's impersonating a parent in an attempt to abduct a child. And on the books today, you could only charge someone that attempted that with criminal mischief. I believe criminal mischief in the fourth degree, which is a much lesser crime than what we're seeking to establish here in this bill. We're seeking to make it a crime of custodial interference in the second degree. And so that's, again, if someone impersonates a parent, attempts to abduct a child. So really the main of the first three sections, we are doing that in Section 2. That's where the new language is. Sections 1 and 3 simply just changed to track for the changes that we're doing in Section 2.
Yeah, Senator
Kennedy,
go ahead.
On that particular issue, will there be accommodations, for example, to contact a school to let them know if there is a custodial issue, and that, in other words, how do the schools know if there is a dispute over custody?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I suppose the schools wouldn't necessarily know. But upon the school reporting it to law enforcement, but you're right, there's no mechanism here to report.
Yeah, it's okay. Just an issue. It's an issue that comes up occasionally, and I wasn't sure if there was a mechanism within the bill itself to alert schools and school districts.
Senator Frickler.
Mr. Chairman, it depends on the level of custodial agreement. There's restraining orders that sometimes are placed on parents, and schools are notified if restraining orders are in place so that they can protect the child appropriately. But beyond that, I'm not sure if there are other ways besides the parent actually notifying the school district to make sure that there are other people that shouldn't be picking up the child. There's a list that's provided to as a parent, when I was in school, I could say who could pick up my child.
Senator Caldwell?
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to say that in order to have your child picked up, you're going to have an approved list that would pick them up if there's going to be that. So this shows that when somebody tries to violate that, then they would be warned that it's going to be a criminal mischief issue. So it was put in, by the way, in committee by Senator Wilkowski, and he could probably help us describe some of it, but it was a very convincing argument that people had actually experienced how to do the problem with this, and they had no charge to levy. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we go back to the issue of the felony break-off, the felony cut-off that's there, has the governor or has the administration weighed in on where they're sitting as far as what limit they want to see, or do they care?
I have not asked him, Mr. Chairman.
I guess an initial comment, I think as you look at some of the rural issues, then some of the felons that are represented out there in rural Alaska, this certainly at a $750 limit does not do them any favors, and especially if they're trying to get jobs when they out-migrate from rural Alaska to the cities, I'm very much in favor of increasing the amount of that's there for the felony cutoff, because I just see people that are disenfranchised getting the short end of the stick from now till they die, because that felony will be on their record until they're put in a grave. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I just want to make my position known on that.
And Mr. Chairman, my problem has not been with the administration, nor, quite frankly, with this body, but I know that I'm going to have a hard time moving this forward unless I can make the case to some of the business owners. So that's where my efforts lie.
Chairman.
Yes, go ahead.
With all due respect, the business owners, and I'm a business owner too, out in rural Alaska. We, business owners, except for ones that are elected, do not vote. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Well, obviously, we're going to have more discussion on this.
Yes, I will take that to the folks who have made the case, and I will keep pushing back.
Okay. Excellent. We'll have more discussion on it. The cost is a big issue to the Finance Committee. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, go ahead, Senator.
You know, just reflecting on Senator Olson's comments, we've had several bills through this community that's trying to help small businesses with reductions of corporate income tax. We had a bill just in front of us here this last week that was trying to incentivize small businesses, and so we are doing things to try to help them out. I just think that we need to hear what their issue is and then balance it, because like you, young folks can make bad decisions and so can older folks, so we'll just continue that conversation, I guess.
Okay, very good. Continue, George, please.
So the next 15 sections are felony theft, as we just discussed. There are about 14 areas in statute where you must go in and change the monetary amount, so that's why it takes so many sections to do so. So sections 20, 21, and 22 establish the 24/7 sobriety program in pretrial. And as you can see on page 10, starting at line 25, we say that a person can be court-ordered into the 24/7 sobriety program. And by the way, the meat of that program, the language where you can see how the program actually works, is on page 14. If that person has been charged with an alcohol-related or substance abuse-related offense, and if that offense is an unclassified felony, a Class A felony, a sexual felony, or a misdemeanor or felony crime of domestic violence, the court can order that person onto 24/7 pretrial. So again, 21, 22, pretrial. 23 is where we deal with how one can get credit for time served in a treatment facility. So this section incentivizes treatment. What it does is, in 2007, there was a bill passed that really restricted an offender's ability to get credit for time served while in residential treatment. And what our bill does is it expands some of the things that a treatment program can allow an offender to do. So, for example, if one is in treatment, they are able to leave the facility. They can get a day pass, assuming it's limited to time and purpose, and they can pursue employment. They can pursue voc tech. They can pursue volunteering, or anything that is, you know, directly related to their treatment. So that could be an NA meeting or an AA meeting off campus. It could be a variety of things. And so we're expanding that a little bit to incentivize treatment, because people will not be interested in voluntarily entering treatment and paying for it by themselves if they are not going to get credit for that time served.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I could just add to that, this was a source of huge debate in the committee because of a court case. A Nygren was the name of the court case, and it's called a Nygren credit. And it really goes to the fact of, if you're supposed to be in jail, how can we make sure that it's jail time you get counted for? And we tried to allow, as best we knew how, treatment while they're still getting jail time credit. Anything that goes outside of what is highly accountable is going to be hard to get to. So we got right close to the edge and tried to keep it that way because they're really supposed to be in jail unless they're getting some jail time. It's a very narrow scope of people who will who get that credit. And it was a test between the public defense, or actually those who defend people and those who prosecute people. And I think we hit a reasonable balance on it. So you're going to probably hear some on this, but I think we worked with the Department of Law to try to find what we thought was the place where those who should be incarcerated do not get kind of freedom. They have to be actually showing benefit of treatment. Then they can get jail time credit for it. So I just wanted to make sure, because you're going to hear some discussion on that in or out of this committee, but I think we found a really decent balance on this. So my apologies for jumping in.
Okay, thank you, Senator Coghill. So treatment being what, 30 days?
Through the chair, treatment could be, most of these guys will be seeking treatment before their trial, so it's really just the amount of time between the charge and the trial, and that could vary.
Gotcha. Thank you.
So continuing on, Section 24, we're going back to talking about 24/7 sobriety, and I just described how Sections 20 through 22 create 24/7 sobriety in the pretrial phase. So what this section does, Section 24, creates 24/7 sobriety in probation. And so again, you can see here on line 26 of page 13, that one condition of probation could be a judge could order you to do testing under AS 3305-020G, and that's on the next page. And so, if you'd like, I can point you to what I'm calling the meat of the program. So that's on the next page, page 14, starting at subsection G. So subsection G, that's on line 20. So the commissioner shall establish a program. That's the commissioner of corrections. And that program requires twice-a-day testing, in person if it's practicable, and that's testing for alcoholic beverages or random testing for controlled substances. And if there is a violation, there's a swift response. And so that's what you see in subsection 2, that's starting on line 27. So if there's a violation, this bill provides a way for the probation officer or the prosecutor's office or local law enforcement to send a notice. They've got 24 hours to send that notice, and then that way law enforcement can respond and the sanction can be applied.
Senator Kelly.
Jordan, do you happen to know how the testing is done? Is it all person to person?
Through the chair, Senator Kelly, not always. So South Dakota is the pioneer of this program. They started in 2005, and they've got about 90% of the people in the program doing in-person testing with another human. But there's 10% of the people in some of these states that live in an area that's rural enough and inconvenient enough to test twice a day where they'll use electronic monitoring. So that's the ankle bracelet. It could be a home-based device where you simply just need a landline connection.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. So this program will work anywhere in Alaska that has a landline and has local law enforcement.
I'm just kind of thinking about the landline part of it. I bet you that's overcomable. I know nothing of these things. It's this technology far beyond me, but it just seems that there's got to be some enterprising person that knows about zeros and ones that can come up with a device that you could stick on the internet and do this. And make a bunch, maybe the state should invest in something like that, seriously.
Research at the university.
There you go.
Put your front section budget.
Through Chair Senator Kelly, I am not an expert, but I am aware, though, that they do have some devices that work wirelessly on cell networks. So we've just discussed the meat of the 24/7 program. That's on page 14, starting subsection G. But let's move up that very same page up to subsection F, which we kind of skipped over. Now, subsection F establishes an entirely different program. It's called PACE, and it's a different way of doing probation. So in Alaska, we have a big problem with people on probation violating the conditions of their probation, committing new crimes, and repeatedly coming in and out of the system. And it's one of the Department of Corrections' biggest cost drivers. We've, like I've said in the last meeting, we have one of the highest recidivism rates in the country, and PACE is designed to address that. So under PACE, when someone violates a condition of their probation, so for example, consuming alcohol, using drugs, missing an appointment, that individual is arrested immediately. They're brought to court within 72 hours, and if the offender violates again, the process is repeated. And so every single probation violation is dealt with quickly, and a sanction is applied each time. So on page 14, starting with line 2, we say the commissioner shall establish a program. That's the Commissioner of Corrections. And this program, while it does rely on swift sanctions, much like 24/7 sobriety, it's a little bit different. This relies on random testing for controlled substances. And it takes away the discretion from probation officers. So if there is a violation, that probation officer does not have a choice about filing a petition to revoke their probation. So here in the bill, line 9 says that the probation officer shall file a petition by the close of the next business day. So sections 27 and 28 take that program I just described and give the parole board the ability to use the program. So section 29 of the bill is where we get into assessments. So section 29 gives the Commissioner of Corrections a new duty, and that duty is to establish a program to conduct assessments of the risks and needs of offenders who are sentenced to serve a term of incarceration of 30 days or more. So currently the Department of Corrections only conducts assessments on less than half of their felons, hardly any of the misdemeanants. And it's very difficult to know if an offender is appropriate for the PACE program or if they need substance abuse treatment or mental health treatment. And so the point of requiring the department to do more assessments is so that we can link offenders up with those services that we know they need. But we don't know they need it unless we assess them. And an assessment takes about 45 minutes to conduct. It's done by probation officers in the institutions. And the fiscal note reflects that. The department estimates that they'll need 11 probation officers to handle the increased volume of the assessments. So section 30 of the bill establishes the Recidivism Reduction Grant Fund. I touched on this a little bit last time, but the way that we release prisoners in Alaska is not working, and it's probably the result. It's probably why we have one of the highest recidivism rates in the country. And what we do here in Alaska, more often than not, is we release these individuals into the parking lot after their incarceration. They don't have first month's rent. They don't have any resources whatsoever. They can't get a job, and oftentimes they'll go right to a homeless shelter if that's even an option for them. And they're back in prison. Most of our recidivism occurs within the first 6 months. And so it's really a critical period where if we could provide some things to those offenders for a limited amount of time, but if we could provide a safety net such as, and you can find this on page 18, line 13 is where we get into the criteria. This fund distributes money to programs that have case management and sober living, so that's a structured environment. And the program must either provide treatment on site, that would be mental health or substance abuse treatment, or at least have the ability to refer them to treatment. And now again, if the department is doing more assessments, when these offenders reach these reentry centers after their release, an assessment will have already been done on them, and the reentry center will have an idea of what they need. The final requirement for the program is the program must require employment or voc training or some kind of volunteer. And then we put a maximum on the number of days one may live in this reentry program. And so an original version of the bill had it at 150 days. Getting some feedback from providers and some people that work in reentry, we heard that 150 days is really not sufficient for reentry, and a year might be more appropriate. Section.
Yes, Senator Coghill, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, on this one, this is actually one of the cost drivers as well. Right now, it resides in this version in the Department of Corrections, and I think the granting and the accountability measures are already residing within the Department of Health and Social Services. And as we get into the next version of this, we intend to change this to show that we don't have to have new employees, we don't have to do new training, and it would go, but it would require that Department of Health and Social Services work with the Department of Corrections in maintaining, establishing, and working this. So I think you'll see us trying to find a way to do this as cost effectively as we can. I just wanted to put that in front of you because it's not in this version right now. But because of the cost, we were trying very, very hard to find ways to make this work better. And you'll see that coming up.
Okay. So, Senator Coghill, you'll give us that input for a future CS?
When we get the language and get it before you, we're hoping the CS will come out where we can lay that in front of you. We're actually working on it kind of as we speak.
And hopefully you're working with Christine as well.
That's what I meant by as we speak.
Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Coghill.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I could just point out the costs that Senator Coghill was just referring to. It's in the fiscal note. And by putting the grant fund in the Department of Corrections, which doesn't have the staff to run a grant fund, they estimate needing six new positions. And so it's our understanding, if it were to be moved over to Health and Social Services, that they already have the infrastructure in place to manage a fund like this and would not require six new personnel. So Section 31 of the bill, and this is the last main component, this is the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. And what these sections do is it lays out the membership of the commission, the staffing, how often the meetings are conducted, the powers and duties of the commission, methodology of the commission, and the fact that they must submit an annual report to the legislature once a year. And the last few sections here, sections 32 through 38, are really applicability transitional provisions. We've got effective dates in here. One thing I want to bring to your attention is the commission has a five-year sunset, which is reflected on page 23. The section of the bill that requires the DOC conduct more assessments, that has a delayed effective date of January 1st, 2016. That's to give the department a little bit of time to transition into that new responsibility. And then, of course, the overall effective date for the bill is July 1st, 2014.
Okay. Thank you. Jordan, I think we got the time, so why don't we go ahead and visit the fiscal notes while we're on the subject. You'll have to tell us which one we're looking at so we can follow along.
Mr. Chairman, we could, if you'd like, we could look at the Department of Corrections fiscal note first. So that is fiscal note number 7.
Some of these are numbered. Some of them don't appear to be numbered.
Dated 2/13/14.
That is correct.
Second to the last. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, it's OMB component number 694.
Okay, I got it. Okay, go ahead. Thank you, Senator.
So, Mr. Chairman, you can see here the total operating is $6.6 million and some change. However, I do want to point out that about my understanding of this fiscal note, and I'm new to fiscal notes, but the $3.3 million says here in the left-hand column, 1005 general fund program, That is money that's coming back to the state through the offender fees paid by the 24/7 sobriety program. But looking at the analysis here on the second page, the department does not expect a fiscal impact for a few sections of our bill. That would be the first few sections that deal with the attempted child abduction. They do not expect a fiscal impact in increasing the felony theft threshold. But where the fiscal impact begins is 24/7 sobriety. And this fiscal note is predicated on three assumptions. The first assumption is that 2,400 offenders will enter the program. And that number was based on, that is the number of people that were released before trial last year. And so this fiscal note assumes that everyone who was released before trial last year, a judge would court order them to 24/7 sobriety. And whether that's realistic or not, I imagine that's for the committee to discuss. And the second assumption that it's based on is that this will cost $10 per day to conduct. And now that's a significant increase than what other states are paying. So South Dakota pays about $2 a day for 24/7 sobriety. I've heard here that we could do it in Alaska for $4 or $5 a day. And so I'll admit I'm a little confused by the $10. And the department is online, Deputy Commissioner Ron Taylor, and he may be able to speak better to those assumptions than I could. And then the final assumption made here is the Department of Corrections assumes that the offenders will spend an average of 6 months on the program. In working with Nancy Mead in the court system, who's here in the room, it's our understanding that that average is a bit high. And in fact, it should be 5 months if you look at the average time to adjudication. So by multiplying those three numbers together, we come up with $4.3 million. However, the analysis here says that receipt support services will pay for the program. So at $10 a day, assuming all of the offenders on the program can afford $10 a day and will pay that, there ought to be no ultimate fiscal impact to the state.
So, I don't know if I understand this correctly. There's going to be 31 new people hired to do this service?
Mr. Chairman, the 31 people that's requested in different is requested in different sections of the fiscal note, the 24/7 sobriety program, they don't anticipate needing new personnel. The new personnel comes in at the next part of the analysis, PACE, and then they also say they need new personnel for something on the third page, that's the risk needs assessments.
Okay.
All right, so the next part of the analysis is PACE for probation and parole. And the Department of Corrections estimates needing 14 new positions. That would be 8 probation officers, 5 criminal justice technicians, and 1 office assistant. And really, adding probation officers to the department would be the legislature allocating, changing the way that the Department of Corrections allocates their resources. Currently, the department spends almost all of its budget and all of its full-time positions on secure confinement. And small portions they delegate to community monitoring, reformative programs, and so this really would be a shift in the way that DOC does business. So on the third page, the analysis continues, and this is where we mandate that the Department of Corrections conduct more assessments. The reason that they are asking for 11 probation officers is probation officers are actually used in the institutions, and that's where assessments occur. And so the probation officers, they have a slightly different training, and they're able to do these risk needs assessments, identify people that need help and need treatment. And so these 11 probation officers would be spread out among 10 different facilities all over the state. Finally, the recidivism reduction grant fund, because this would be a new responsibility for the DOC, they say they will need 6 new positions. That would be a grants administrator 3, 2 grants administrator 2s, an accounting technician, an internal auditor, and an admin assistant. That comes out to $600,000, which as we spoke about earlier, it's possible that the Department of Health and Social Services can take on the responsibility of the fund without additional personnel.
Okay, let's hope they can. All right, any questions on that fiscal note? It's a fairly large one. Okay, go on. Yes, Senator Olson, did you have
something? Well, at the end, I'd like to ask a question on the fiscal note in general.
Okay. All right.
So Mr. Chairman, I'm done running through the fiscal note. I will say, though, that that I think there are a lot of incorrect assumptions in the 24/7 sobriety section, and I think that there are some things that could be looked at carefully there.
Okay. What there are other fiscal notes, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. We have another one from the court system.
That was $320,000?
So. That is correct. When the Alaska Sentencing Commission existed in the early 1990s, they staffed the commission with 3 people, an attorney, a research analyst, and an admin assistant. And because the commission that we propose really duplicates the responsibilities that that earlier sentencing commission had, we opted to go for the same setup. So what this fiscal note says is the court system, the judicial council will need an attorney, they'll need a full-time secretary, and they need a full-time research analyst. And this commission does not have an executive director, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, do you agree with this fiscal note as well?
Mr. Chairman, it's hard to say. I think that would be a policy call of the committee whether to push back on that or not.
Okay. Is there any more?
Those are the only 2 of the fiscal impact.
Okay, Senator Olson.
Mr. Schilling, as you look at the whole situation, I'd like to go back to the idea of the felony cutoff of $750. If we do bring it up to a significant amount, let's say $1,200 or even close to $1,500, do you see an effect to the fiscal note there where you're not going to be prosecuting felons and there'd be a savings in the long run related to that? Or is that a theory that's out there that has no substance to it?
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator Coghill.
What I'll try to do, first of all, Senator Olson, is I'll try to get a side-by-side comparison of what a felony conviction cost and what a misdemeanor or property crime would cost. There is going to be some difference. There's no doubt about that. And I can extrapolate it against how many charges we would expect in a year. That might be a little more difficult because presently we charge and then negotiate out or do some bargaining, so they might get charged with a felony and then end up only being convicted on a misdemeanor. So I'll try to weed through that as best I can. My expectation is to save money on that, but the real savings in my view is going to be that restitution is going to be easier to be gotten to, and people will not have to have a felony charge on their life or a felony conviction on their life when it really doesn't fit the level of charge or conviction.
I totally agree, Mr. Chairman. And last last comment or question that I have has to do with one of the things that Senator Kelly brought up, was that if you have 10% of the people in Alaska, like they do in South Dakota, that are being tested electronically or not face-to-face anyway, and you do have an issue where you have some person out there in Tutuliak or Kaktovik, and their meter goes off the peg and shows that they've been drinking, and you got to get out there, and it's going to be fairly expensive, I think, to unless there's some way you can restrict them from getting that far away, but you charter an airplane or have them even get on a regular scheduled flight, that gets expensive for them to come on in, and many times these people are resistant to get on, so they may need some coaxing. So I see that as being a pretty expensive endeavor, being in the transportation system myself.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the expectation would be that these programs would really only be applied where they're most practicable. And so, these programs won't work in the most rural places in Alaska, places without law enforcement, VPSOs, or the capabilities with the devices.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
I think there still will be some expense because I think you're still going to be able to have that. But I think if you take the population that is on the road system generally, the cost savings way outweigh those, what I would consider probably the less volume cases. So I think by the time people on monitoring pay their way, are more productive in society, doing less driving, drunk, or domestic violence, community safer, and we're not paying the $160 or $80 a day to have them in jail. So I think that the cost savings will be significant, but there are going to be those cost outliers. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at zero fiscal note OMB component 768. From the trial courts. And if you turn to page 2, paragraph 3, it says these changes will impact the court if they result in significant number of cases moving from the superior court where felonies are handled and the relative cost per case is higher to district courts where misdemeanors are often handled at a lower cost per case. However, a review of available information shows that because of the way cases in this category are prosecuted and processed, the majority of property crimes impacted by this bill are already resolved in the district court or dismissed or resolved early in the life of the case. Because of this, the bill will not have a measurable fiscal impact on the court system. So I just throw that out for the sponsor to
Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate that from the court system, but we still are going through all the efforts of making the charge. We have to get the prosecutor, so there's other charges, other costs, and I can tell you one of the issues that we were debating just in committee the other day was if somebody's charged with a felony. And it may very well get pled down. It goes on court view as being charged with a felony. And that has a lifelong impact.
Yes, it does. Okay. Thank you. Senator Fairclough, anything else?
Mr. Chairman, I'll need to read it again, but do we have auditing requirements? Is there a setup schedule? I see that we have a sunset, but is there an auditing provision then of the effectiveness and efficiency of the council?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, currently the bill does not have that.
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, that would be an expectation to have in another CS, because I do agree that the auditing provision is something that we should be doing.
Okay, Senator Kelly.
Sure, I just had a thought that possibly to resolve some of the issues around the raising of the threshold level for felonies is that we might sunset that provision, is to make a change and sunset it so we can come back and study how it operated over the years. Just a suggestion. So.
Yeah, I think we'd want to ask somebody in the court system what they thought of that. Because if it sunsets in 4 years, depending on what side you are of that sunset, you might be a felony or it might be a misdemeanor.
And Mr. Chairman,
yes.
To be fair, even going up to this, we had to figure out an applicability measure that if somebody is charged and this goes into law before they're sentenced, how do we deal with that? And so it is going to be one of those mechanical issues on how you deal with it. So a sunset would create another mechanical, how do you do that problem, you know?
Senator Kelly?
Something also that might be interesting to do, because I think the amount is so low that it's creating problems that we never would have anticipated. I'd even be in favor of a look back and removing those felonies from people's records, because we are way under the amount. I mean, if the number you said is 2,500 and we're stuck at 500, I wonder how many years you have to go back before felony intersects with $500 in real dollars. That's probably back in the 80s sometime.
Mr. Chairman, we did at least have a graph that showed that if you're at $1,000, that's well within normal state's operation at this point. So that's why we headed in that direction.
Yeah.
And just practically, I couldn't get there yet.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, and Senator Kelly, you know, having done the work you have in FAS and myself, that sometimes, you know, these kids just don't know better, and they might steal a snow machine, and all of a sudden they're a felon now. And all it really took was just someone to sit down and work with them and say, you know, you don't do that. So yeah, that is concerning. So I think you started out your presentation here saying actually, even though the fiscal notes are large, that in the long run it may actually save the state money. I think your goal here is to reduce recidivism. Do you have a goal or target of how much you hope to reduce recidivism by implementing a program like this, or is just a conceptual thought, or have you given that much analysis?
Mr. Chairman, so most of the programs in here are evidence-based programs. There's a lot of data. There's a lot of states that are doing them, and we actually have real tangible numbers on the reduction of jail days for people in PACE, for example. Currently, the department is experiencing a drop in recidivism about a percentage point over 3 or 4 years. We obviously expect ours to do much more dramatic than that. And I can get numbers to the different offices to project some savings if you'd like.
Okay, very good. And then also, what do you do with those that can't afford the $10 a day testing? Are we setting up another kind of Medicaid-type program, or we'd have to fund that for folks?
Mr. Chairman, it is certainly possible in Alaska to conduct 24/7 sobriety for much less than $10 a day. However, it is... One would hope, if they are sober, that they can come up with $2 a day. We have heard anecdotally from other states that are doing 24/7 that it just simply has not been an issue for them. I believe it would be unconstitutional to jail someone due to their inability to pay.
Okay. I just hope we're not, by accident, having to set up another fund to help fund those who can't afford to pay for the daily testing. So you're going to work for my office on a new CS, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And I'll have to say, too, we seem to create a lot of task force, so that scares me a little bit. So I too, want to read the bill a little more closer. I know Senator Kelly's had us reading that Senate Bill 138, that little bill, so probably everyone needs to take another look at this. And then we'll have a CS hopefully ready in the next day or two. So I see no need to meet tomorrow unless you guys just want to come here and have fun again. Okay. We'll cancel or we'll adjourn this meeting and not meet at all tomorrow. And then plan on coming back Monday at 9. I think we're going to take up Senate Bill 138. If not, we do have some other bills scheduled. That would be the extending the Seismic Hazard Safety Commission, another commission. That's Senator Bishop's. And then there's House Bill 298, Confidentiality of Performance Reviews. I think that's Speaker Schnultz. And we'll take those up if Senate Bill 138 is not ready. Otherwise, we'll take up Senate Bill 138, the gas, at 5 o'clock on Monday. And then we'll revisit this bill on Tuesday. Hopefully, we'll have the CS, and we do plan on having public testimony on this as well. Anything else?
Mr. Chair.
Fenley? Yes.
If you're not meeting tomorrow, when would you like the individual whose phone went off to bring the donuts?
Oh, yeah, donuts, yes. Monday.
Thank you.
You're right. Okay, Tuesday. Senator Faircloth's not here Monday. She doesn't want to miss out on the donut. Are they both his? And, you know, we are becoming more healthier, too, and we have a doctor on the committee. So if you want to bring fruit or something else. Okay. All right. With that, if there's nothing else, we are adjourned till Monday morning at 9:00.